positive news on the jobs front this weekend. The U.S. Labor Department says the economy added 216,000 jobs in March, and the unemployment rate dropped to 8.8%. But there's some caveats. There's still more than 6 million Americans who are classified as long-term unemployed, those who've been looking for work for 27 weeks or longer. And it's not just more experienced workers who are having a hard time finding employment. As NPR's Siri Grassley reports, it's a tough job market for young people, too.
Madison Cox dreamed of a great life as a hairstylist.
I thought, you know, I'm going to find this really nice salon and, you know, I'm going to be able to buy a new car and all this kind of stuff. And that is totally not what happens.
She hit roadblocks almost immediately after graduating from cosmetology school last year. The first obstacle was an apprenticeship. Most salons require stylists to do one before they'll hire them. But Cox had a hard time finding one that worked for her. Most are full-time, and they don't pay. But Cox is 24 and a single mom. She had her son Sam when she was 16 and says she can't afford to work for free.
A lot of people who don't have kiddos, you know, that's okay for them, and they have the time to do that, but I have to be very selective.
Cox eventually landed a paid apprenticeship, but couldn't keep up with the partying lifestyle of her coworkers. So she's been unemployed since October. She makes some money doing hair out of her house in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, but says it's scary not having a consistent income. Cox is just one of the thousands of young people without a job. The unemployment rate is 23% for people like her who just have a high school diploma. That's over 2.5 times what it is for the general population. Cox knows that without her son, things might be easier. She'd be able to crash on couches or get a roommate. But now her routine has to center around Sam. She says it's important that he doesn't see her struggle.
It's all about your game face. I think a lot of it is I pretend like everything is okay.
Looking back, Cox admits she was naive.
I think I aimed too high, and my expectations were unrealistic. It's disappointing, you know, knowing that all these dreams that I had were kind of silly.
Still, she hasn't given up on the dream yet and thinks she may have found a way around the apprenticeship problem. Cox hopes she can skip one by becoming a cosmetology instructor. But for many people her age, even a college degree isn't a guarantee. According to the National Association of Colleges and Employers, recent grads entered one of the grimmest job markets for young people in years. In 2007, over half of students had jobs at graduation. Last year, only a quarter of them did. Mandy Jacobs was smart enough to know that her bachelor's degree in sociology wasn't going to bring in the big bucks, so she went back to school, but not grad school, community college.
I did get a few odd looks.
Jacobs is 26 now, and 2 years ago, she thought her ticket was healthcare. Everyone and everything said it would be in high demand as the baby boomers aged. So she got an associate's degree in radiation therapy from a school in Indiana. By graduation, she had defined skills and hours of on-the-job experience.
I thought I was great on paper. I thought I was good to go.
She applied all over the country, but could hardly land an interview. When a few of her classmates got jobs, she was puzzled.
I'm happy for them. I'm glad they got jobs because we all deserve one. But it was a little twinge of jealousy.
Jacob's bad luck may be the result of a simple supply and demand problem. While she was in training, the need for radiation therapists plummeted. Since graduation, Jacobs has been getting by with 2 part-time jobs. But she finally got some good news. Jacobs' boss told her one of those jobs in radiation safety will turn full-time in the summer. She's disappointed she won't get to work with patients, and it's not exactly the future she expected. But it's one she's happy with for now. Siri Grassley, NPR News.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Oliver Walcher is an anxious adolescent growing up in Manchester, England in the 1950s. Jewish immigrants from a part of Eastern Europe he calls bug country. All we've been doing since the Middle Ages was growing beetroot and running away from Cossacks. But his father was a yo-yo champ, and his mother is glamorous with what he calls white fishball cheeks. Oliver is shy with girls, doesn't know where he fits into the world that's coming into being, but at least he has ping pong. That's right, ping pong. The story of Oliver Walcher, coming of age in the novel The Mighty Walcher, was acclaimed when it was published in Great Britain more than 10 years ago. Its author, Howard Jacobson, won the Man Booker Prize last year for his novel, The Finkler Question, and now The Mighty Walcher is being published in the United States. And in his 60s now, Howard Jacobson is being compared to Philip Roth in his prime. Howard Jacobson joins us from our studios in London. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And critics, who, as I note, love this novel, called it autobiographical because you're from Manchester. Is it autobiographical?
Well, you know how difficult this is, the whole autobiographical question. There's a sense in which I'm the kind of novelist for whom every novel is autobiographical in a way, in that it's the story of my soul, if not the story of the life that I've lived. But this one more than ever is. I did indeed play table tennis. I did indeed dream of being a world champion like my hero, Oliver Walcher. I failed. I shouldn't give the story away, but anybody will know pretty soon that he's not going to succeed. It is pretty much the story of my life in table tennis, if you like, in Manchester in the 50s.
Of course, Oliver's first paddle is a book, a leatherette-covered book. Was that true with you?
It is. I did play with that. I played with those. I don't know whether you have them over there. We read our classics. I read Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre and other works like that in these little green leatherette World's Classics, I think they were called. And that was the book that was to hand, and that was what I practiced with. And then I decided this would make me really good because the book had an uneven surface, mm-hmm. So the ball would come off at all sorts of strange angles. I thought if I can play well with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which is the bat Oliver Walcher plays with, I think I probably cheated. I think I played with Wuthering Heights, probably. Then I thought I'd be even better when it came to playing with a bat. And for a little while, I was right. I was good. When I was young, I was good. For a 14-year-old, I was good, as indeed Oliver Walcher is good as a 14-year-old.
Mm. Yeah, it just occurred to me. I mean, if you use a leatherette-bound version of War and Peace, Your stroke might be slow because of the weight, but Animal Farm, for example, you should zip right through a game.
Yes, or a short story by Hemingway could have been good, yes.
What did table tennis do to uplift Oliver Walcher?
It gave him an activity. It took him out of his shyness. He's a very introspective boy, very shy boy. He was the colour of beetroot the whole time, right throughout his adolescence, as indeed was I. You can play table tennis and not feel anybody's watching because nobody is. You can feel that you are, you play it in a small room. It somehow matches your mind. It doesn't liberate you from your shyness, but it puts no pressure on your shyness. Oliver Walcher could not have gone out and played on a tennis court. He could not have dreamed of playing tennis in front of, thousands of adoring people, though he wants adoring fans, it's true. It's a tight, small game, and it suited the small tightness of his nature at that time, as well as which it gave him friends. I mean, the wonderful thing about playing table tennis is you play on a team, and I wrote about this with great lovingness, what it's like every Thursday night in a Manchester winter to get into a car with five of your friends. They're all older than Oliver, as they were all older than me, who tease him, who introduce him to sex, who give him a little bit more confidence. It gave him friends. It gave him a family. He has sisters at home. This gave him brothers, so it gave him camaraderie. And also, in the end, when he becomes good at the game and starts to win, it gives him a real sense of achievement, victory.
Yeah. We're speaking with Howard Jacobson about his novel, The Mighty Walcher. Does every young man have a Lorna Peachley?
Lorna Peachley, the girl with the all-moving body parts.
Yeah.
Yes, I think you either find one or you imagine one. And just between ourselves, there was one. Lots of these characters are made up, but Lorna Peachley is, well, look, I think there was one. I think I saw a girl just like that. I even have a feeling her name was Lorna. I had a feeling I couldn't even bear to change her name. And that was how she looked to me. Whether she was in fact like that, whether there, I mean, I'm beginning to feel like Anthony talking about Cleopatra now. Was there such a Lorna, or did I dream her? Maybe I dreamed her out of God knows what recesses of my sick imagination. But I think there was such a girl. And of course, there's immense amount of fun and rude fun at that, about the men playing with Lorna Peachley and playing certain strokes which would get her to run around the table and come charging in so they could watch and enjoy those moving body parts.
Yeah. You have a line in there which I wrote down and I liked so much, where Oliver says to himself, "I feel sorry for lovely girls. They feel they are the cause of their own troubles, but are never quite sure why."
Yes.
Help us puzzle that out.
Let's puzzle it out. Well, I suppose this is someone feeling that he's had a very troubled relationship with this girl. He does end up having a relationship with this girl. There's something of the masochist in Oliver Walzer. I think I argue somewhere in the novel that you have to be a masochist to play a game which has so few rewards. He's a loser. I write about losers. I think most novelists write about losers. We love losers. We're not interested in winners. This would not have been a touching or funny novel had Oliver Walzer become the world's greatest table tennis player and become a millionaire. He is a loser, and he's interested in loss. And romantically and erotically, that transfers into sorts of feelings for Lorna that she just doesn't know what to do with.
Mm. You studied at Cambridge under the very famous professor, literary critic, F.R. Leavis.
Yes.
What was that like?
He was a wonderful teacher of reading. He taught you how to read with great closeness. He removed all the clutter of literature from your mind. You know, the idea that you had to know things outside the work. The idea that, you know, before you could read a book, you had to know so much and you had to study so much. He was terrific at getting you, read the book. Everything you need to know about this poem is in this poem. And if you need to know about the world behind the poem, this poem is the introduction to that world. You read the poem before you read anything about the poem. And he was a wonderfully sensitive reader himself. He felt particularly poetry, but also novels, with great force. And he conveyed that. He was terrific at teaching you what it's like. When all is said and done, this was what it was. He taught you what it was like to really love a work of literature and to take it seriously. And I carried that round with me forever, really. Even now, I haven't been a teacher myself for over 20 years, as long as I've been writing. But I still hear his words. I think he would not like what I write. I don't think he liked funny books, and I like to write funny as well as touching books. But I still feel, whether he would have liked them or not, that, you know, I am writing something that he ought to have liked.
Howard Jacobson, who won last year's Man Booker Prize, and his coming-of-age novel, The Mighty Walzer, is now just being published in the United States. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for talking to me. Really enjoyed it.
We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
Part of the demonstrator rushed into our compound with weapons, and they stormed the compound. They put fire on it, and they killed several of our staff.
That's Alain Leroy. He's the UN's Undersecretary General of the Department of Peacekeeping Operations. He's talking about yesterday's attack in northern Afghanistan on a UN compound that left 12 people dead. The demonstrators were set off after learning of a Quran burning in Florida. James Fallows of The Atlantic joins us now, as he does most Saturdays, to help us put some of these stories in perspective. Jim, hi.
Hello, Guy.
It seems, Jim, almost bizarre that what we would perceive as obviously ugly but protected behavior, the burning of a Quran, could set off murders halfway around the world.
It certainly does. And I think that Western-style democracies, and particularly the United States, have evolved over centuries the difficult concept that there can be deplorable and yet still legal speech. While Pastor Terry Jones was certainly within his rights, his legal rights, to do what he did, I think it was wise for the U.S. and world news media to play it down as much as they could, and it cannot help but be another problem, you know, to put it in the mildest possible terms, between the U.S. and Afghanistan.
It must mark some kind of shift, though, in the thinking among UN officials. I mean, it has to.
There was a very moving post I saw online by a UN official saying that this was not the beginning of the end for a number of NGO and aid workers in Afghanistan. It was, from her point of view, the end, because the tensions had grown so extreme between international officials, especially Americans, and much of the Afghan populace because of real or perceived affronts against Islam or the Afghan population. I think it may also mark a shift in American opinion about Afghanistan. It's inevitable that at some point the U.S. public would come to the conclusion that we are not going to be there forever. And it's possible that this kind of explosion, this kind of horror may have a ripple effect in that way.
Jim, I want to turn to Libya for a moment because, of course, we all watched the president's speech this past week. He never used the word war. But I wonder whether this is already being framed as Obama's war.
There are terms of art about what is a war and what is a police action and what is an intervention, but by any common sense definition of the term, when you're bombing people, when you have troops exposed to combat, you have people both civilian and otherwise being killed, that is a war. And I think this is almost without recent precedent in how much it is the president's own personal war. He has not yet asked for congressional authorization, which he doesn't have to do under the War Powers Act for some time to come. But the only precedent I can think of a American leader taking the responsibility for such an action so entirely upon himself was Ronald Reagan with the Grenada invasion in 1983, which was relatively contained and which President Reagan actually welcomed the idea of reasserting American military might after Vietnam. I think this means among the many consequential events that turn on how this goes in Libya is the president's own fate, too, because this is his war for better or for worse.
It's also been interesting to see how Obama's supporters, those who elected him, have responded to the intervention in Libya.
It was striking to see a column by Thomas Friedman in the New York Times whose concluding paragraph was, "Well, I hope President Obama is lucky." Mm-hmm. And Andrew Sullivan, a very prolific blogger at my own Atlantic Monthly site, again had the same argument that he was very wary and chary of the judgment that went into this, but now he just hoped it turned out well.
That's James Fallows. He's national correspondent for The Atlantic. He joins us most Saturdays on this program. You can find his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Guy.
So if you ever watch late-night television, you may have noticed something about the shows playing on those classic TV channels. On Nick at Night, for instance, you used to be able to catch old shows like The Brady Bunch. But starting this fall, Nickelodeon's late-night lineup will feature television so recent, most people over 25 haven't even heard of it. Producer Brent Bachman reports on nostalgia for a time barely gone by.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Dan.
I'm Brent.
Here's a trick. Next time you meet someone born after, say, 1985, just mention Nickelodeon and the 90s. Instant conversation starting. That's because, if you haven't done the math already, in the 90s, people now in their 20s were children. And arguably, the last generation to use television as their main cultural snorkel to the universe.
I specifically remember sitting in front of the TV.
As close to the TV as I could.
Close enough that I could reach out and touch it.
This very scientific panel of young people, by the way, is made up of a few interns here at NPR, Dan, Becky, and Megan. And you're how old?
I am 22 years old.
23. I'm 21.
They're all children of the 1990s.
And kids' television up until that point was actually developed through an adult point of view looking into a kid's world.
That is Seema Zargami,
the president of Nickelodeon.
She's talking about shows like Clarissa Explains It All.
The first show where a girl really spoke directly to camera about all the issues and comedy that goes with being a tween.
Or Pete and Pete.
No, not a typo. A fabulously funny show, very quirky, about two brothers with the same name.
And people in their 20s have a deep relationship with this kind of television. It's from their childhood. That's not unusual.
In television, everything comes back approximately 20 years after it first existed. But I think this is the first time it's happened quite so young.
And there could be reasons for that nostalgia. Children of the 1990s came of age in a time of constant war, economic anxiety, and a pretty depressing job market.
Perhaps most importantly for this generation, it was a time before ubiquitous communication.
Eric Kleinenberg,
that's me,
is a sociologist at New York University. And he says it seems significant that young people are nostalgic for a time barely 10 years ago.
I've been wondering whether it's possible that this is a generation that goes in front of the television and watches old shows precisely to get away from the media torrent.
In other words, TV used to be part of the noise of modern life. But when you think about all the ways your attention is divided today...
I have my radio that wakes me up.
It's Morning Edition from NPR.
My smartphone.
That I check for email.
Three email addresses.
Blogs on my Google Reader.
A lot of news and politics.
Listen to a podcast on the way to work.
I don't have any sort of MP3 player.
What do you do on your way to work?
Check online and answer emails.
Probably Facebook. Four
other email addresses.
Address work email. Email. Yeah, address.
At the end of the day, compared to that, television almost feels like a relief.
But I do think when I, you know, when I turn off my phone and turn off my computer and sit in front of the TV, I am very calm.
It seems in a weird way that television is a way of shutting off the media.
One paradox in all this is that new media led to Nickelodeon's programming decision in the first place. The network noticed huge enthusiasm for these older programs online. And which specific shows are broadcast will be voted on through social networks.
We'll pick the, you know, four or five that we start with, but from then on in, we'll do it based on demand and we'll have some fun with that.
Nickelodeon is counting on the fact that people like 22-year-old Dan Marica will stay engaged with those shows. And he says he probably will, because most people his age will.
It's the fact that it's something we all relate to in a world that there's not many things that are so relatable.
It's a connection when there are fewer ways to connect.
Exactly. Right, it's a connection when there's fewer ways to connect. Exactly.
Isn't that kind of sad in a way, though?
I think so. I don't think it's a terrible thing.
Again, Eric Kleinenberg from New York University.
Perhaps the good news is that they're looking for a time when they could be by themselves and, you know, to let their mind wander and to develop some sense of themselves.
Brent Bachman, NPR News.
Underdog Cinderella's powerhouses, they are all playing in today's semifinal games in the NCAA men's basketball tournament. Butler versus Virginia Commonwealth, Connecticut against Kentucky. And the man who ties the threads all together, NPR's Mike Pesca.
The terminal tetrad of teams fit into reliable classifications. The Huskies and Bulldogs are canines, the Kentucky Wildcats are feline, and the VCU Rams are, of course, ovine. But that's not what I'm talking about. I speak of the sub-classifications of the parties involved. For instance, Butler and VCU have been depicted all week as underdogs. Lost is the kind of underdog they are. VCU coach Shaka Smart describes his team.
Our guys like playing fast. They love throwing the ball ahead and shooting it or attacking.
The Rams are therefore viewed as the streaky team, whereas the word to describe Butler is, as Smart puts it,
Butler is as sound as anybody that we've played all year.
As far as the Connecticut-Kentucky game, it's being portrayed as teams full of future NBA players helmed by coaches who've been chastened for chasing future NBA players. But there is a difference. Kentucky coach John Calipari is less respected by the national media than his counterpart Jim Calhoun. Calhoun, a Hall of Famer, has won championships. Calipari's experience includes two past Final Four appearances, which were since vacated by the NCAA. This uncomfortable fact was gingerly broached in yesterday's press conference.
John, I'm being facetious, but how does it feel to coach in your first Final Four?
I don't deal with that. We've been here three times. Those players played those games and did what they were supposed to.
Calipari sminced, half smile, half wince, as he answered. He's been asked versions of this question before. Calhoun, on the other hand, who is to be suspended for a few games next season for past recruiting violations, has gone a month, dating back to the beginning of the Big East tournament, without being questioned about these sanctions in an official press conference. Yesterday, he was put on the spot.
If anybody wants to drag up an experience that's happened for 2 years and bring it back up, that's their choice. I'm going forward because I'm going forward with my life.
Calhoun is a fighter, but a winner. Calipari is accomplished, but his success has been officially erased, and his ultimate prize remains as yet unattained. Mike Pesca, NPR News, Houston, Texas.